The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Just want to check the sound. How is that? You can hear? Okay, let me know. Okay, well, it's nice for me to be back here, and it feels like a little bit of a homecoming. I haven't been here in a while. I've been a member of this community, a practitioner, since the late 90s. I can't believe it myself. Something like 20 years or more, 25 years. I still, every time I come here, I still remember the first time I came to IMC when we were meeting at the Quaker Friends Meeting House in Palo Alto. I don't know if anyone remembers that. And there can be a kind of magic in being a beginner and the first time you do something. And I was just talking to someone here who's kind of here for the first, I don't know if there's anyone else here for the first time or meditating for the first time. Yeah. And you know, in Buddhism, beginner's mind is a wonderful thing. You know, it's when we're totally open, something is new and is fresh and full of possibility, and we kind of have an innocence or a purity, you know. And, you know, if you've done this a lot or done anything a lot, it's kind of like, oh, I know what's going to happen, right? I'm going to sit down. I mean, I feel it myself, you know. It's like I look at my cushion at home and I'm like, well, I know what's going to happen. I'm going to go sit down and breathe for a while and then get up, right? And I think it's a very natural thing, a very human thing to think we know something. We want a kind of certainty or predictability. And then part of the power and the beauty of a practice like this is we are opening to what's unknown and what's uncertain. And who knows what's going to happen? We don't know what our mind is going to serve up to us. What's going to, you know. And so to sit down and to have this practice of moment to moment, just being with this mind, this body, this heart, I mean, it's so simple. You know, it's so simple. But I think it's also, you know, a beautiful thing, a deep thing. And I'm always surprised by the experience of sitting, you know. And to this person who's new here today, I gave my very brief beginner's instruction, which is just two words: accept everything. You know, whatever happens, whatever comes in, and you know, we're not trying to create some particular experience. You know, not even calm, not even peace, not even enlightenment. We're here to just accept this moment as it is, moment to moment, things as they are, life as it is. And then in doing that, you know, this kind of Dharma field develops, this Dharma field that little by little expands, maybe, I don't know, expands and kind of can hold what's here, can hold what arises in consciousness. And so it's a great thing to be a beginner And so we envy you. So one of the reasons for me it's nice to be back is having been, you know, so I started sitting with this group in the late 90s, and then began teaching around 2013 or so. And then when COVID happened, I got the idea or the little inspiration that I wanted to expand my own understanding of Western psychology. So I went to grad school for to train in psychotherapy, and I just finished that. And so now I feel a little more space and time to kind of to be here. And one of my interests is kind of the intersection of Eastern thought and Buddhism and Western psychology and psychotherapy, psychoanalytic thinking. So anyway, just a warning, you might you might hear something. And then the other way I feel like I'm back or I'm home is I was just in Asia for about 6 weeks, and Japan, and then also a little bit in Thailand and Cambodia. So maybe I'll talk about that a little bit. One of the I think one of the ways my own understanding of meditation has changed or evolved is kind of like what I was saying, in a sense of like, you know, this shift from trying to get something or trying to use meditation. You know, meditation is powerful. It can be a great tool for things. And to sort of get my mind the way I want it to be. You know, I want to have less of this and this and this, and more of this and this and this. And that's okay. But now I feel this kind of reverence for, you know, as he was saying, this attitude of acceptance. And not only accepting what arises, but it's like, you know, seeing the contents of our mind as something valuable for us. That there's some, you know, the things we think about, the kind of patterns of thought, or the images that come up in meditation, or the memories that come up, or the concerns, the anxieties, or the dreams, the hopes. These are kind of like our treasures in a way. And I think it's a, you know, personally, I think it's a mistake to dismiss, you know, oh, that's just thinking, or that's just imagining or dreaming or something. This is so valuable. This is like the, you know, Freud talked about dreams as the, I'm not such a popular guy these days, but talked about dreams as the royal road to the unconscious. So, you know, there's one way to think of what we dream about when we're sleeping is it's random static, right? It's just the kind of detritus of our brain secretions. You know, maybe it's totally random. But maybe our dreams in some way reflect our inner life and our inner state. And maybe there's a place for looking at that and finding insight in that. So I think when we meditate, it's like to let ourselves be bored, to let ourselves be agitated, to let ourselves have this experience of the mind wandering. And I was giving a talk at a kind of vocational school in Cambodia, where this nonprofit that I admire and I support has all these different training programs and builds schools and does all these things. And one of the things I got a little bit surprised myself in saying is that it's so valuable to be bored. You know, and these days, with, I feel it myself when I have a moment when nothing's really going on, my hand just goes, you know where, where I keep my phone, I take out my phone, and there's probably something good there, something interesting. So less and less these days do we have this experience of simply being with ourselves. And, you know, in an uncomplicated way. I remember some years ago, maybe it was like 10 years ago, and I happened to be in Tokyo with my Zen teacher. Some of you may have known Mel Weitzman from the Berkeley Zen Center. And we were in Tokyo and we happened to be riding on the subway. And when I first came to Japan, I was amazed because, you know, the subways are so quiet. I'm from New York City and it's a little more activity in a subway car, screaming and singing. And it was so quiet. And then so like, what is everyone doing in this quiet? And that when I first went to Japan, probably 2002, 2003, so it was before the iPhone, and everyone was reading. And they have these little books. And, you know, I think the way Japanese language is, you can kind of say a lot in a few characters. So the kind of books are really kind of small. And everyone seemed to be reading these little books. And what I kind of thought was interesting was everyone had this kind of book cover on. So you couldn't see what another person is reading, right? You know, it's a little kind of private thing or privacy. And so then in this memory of being with Mel, about 10 years ago, you know, people had iPhones and it was like every single person was looking on their phone doing something. Except for one person, Mel, my Zen teacher. And he was kind of just sitting there, you know, looking around, looking at people, looking out the window. And so I felt like, well, I can't take out my phone. You know, I have to kind of be present, right? And it wasn't like we were really talking that much. But it was such a wonderful, you know, teaching for me that, you know, to have this time with ourselves and not need to fill it up with something, even if it's good, even if it's productive, even if there's all kinds of great things to read and see and research. But I think the... You know, so anyway, just to say that maybe one of the most valuable things about coming to a place like this and sitting down into this, you know, just opening into the silence, into the stillness, is just restoring some sense of balance. We're always out there. We're always engaged and kind of immersed in, you know, kind of, you could say the object of consciousness, you know, we're kind of thinking about something, to do something. We have some agenda, which is fine, which is good. But this is like a chance to restore a little balance. And then what I find for myself is it creates space. You know, it's like we usually don't notice, unless maybe you're an artist or something and you're attuned to composition or something, like a visual artist. We don't usually notice the empty space in a room, right? Or the empty space on a page. But that's the source. That's the source of possibility. That's the source of renewal. And so in meditation, we're sort of training ourselves to let go of the fixation and the obsession with the objects and the stuff, and to maybe relax a little bit into the empty space. And when I feel this kind of spaciousness, then sometimes there's room for different kinds of content to arise, different kinds of images, different kinds of dreams, different kinds of thoughts. And so creativity and inspiration, I think, is often connected to this discipline of being still and being open and being present and accepting whatever shows up, you know, and whatever shows up is Dharma. Whatever shows up, we use it. We meet it. So in a way, it's like a little bit like a dream state. You know, we're in and out. We're not thinking about something in a maybe intentional way, but things are coming and going, and thoughts are coming and going. And so this nonprofit that was kind of hosting me in Thailand and Cambodia is called Child's Dream. So, you know, kind of the theme of a dream, right? Child's Dream. And Child's Dream Foundation. And this organization was a kind of the dream or the inspiration of two men who were Swiss bankers about 20 years ago. And they were doing banking in Asia. And so they got to know, I think maybe based in Singapore and Hong Kong and these different places, and got to know a little bit of Southeast Asia and the Mekong Delta. And, you know, Thailand is a pretty developed country. You know, there's definitely rural areas. But if you go to Bangkok, it's like more advanced than San Francisco, like the transit system and the high rises. But then, you know, expanding a little bit from Thailand, there's Burma, Myanmar, which right now is, you know, there's a lot of conflict there, and Cambodia and Laos. And these countries are, I was a little bit surprised to learn, on about the same level of the human happiness index or the human development index as the poorest countries in Africa. So they're kind of like 158 out of 160 or something of countries. So there's a lot of poverty and a lot of need in these places. And so these bankers, who one was, I think, in his mid-20s and one was in his mid-30s, said, okay, we've had this experience of managing the wealth of billionaires, you know, and that's nice. But, you know, for our own sense of balance and meaning and purpose, we want to do something a little bit different. And so they started this educational nonprofit. And the first donors were their former clients, you know, at the Swiss bank. And so, I've been so part of the reason I know about this organization is one of the things I do in the summers is bring university students, mostly from Japan, to Southeast Asia. And, it's kind of a cross-cultural educational experience that comes out of via, I don't know, you might know this wonderful organization called Volunteers in Asia, and the founder of which was at Stanford for many years. And anyway, so in the process of finding different places for us to visit in Thailand, I found this nonprofit. And the students are so inspired by what they're doing. And so they're building schools, you know, places like Cambodia. I think they've built like 300 schools. And they also provide pathways for refugees from Myanmar. That, not to go into the whole situation, but you may know that there's a kind of civil war happening in Myanmar. So many people have walked out of the country and into Thailand because the border is kind of open. But then if you're in Thailand, you have no papers, you have nothing. Thailand doesn't really want you. You don't have a passport from your country. And so it's a very vulnerable place to be. And then imagine you're a young person. Well, you can't go to Thai school. So what are you going to do? Right? How do you go to school? So organization like this, you know, creates kind of non-formal schools for these migrant population and refugees. And so all this amazing stuff happening. And one of the... When I bring the university students to meet with the founders of this organization, part of it is to learn about what they're doing, to learn about the need there. But then part of it is also to give these founders a chance to talk about their own life journey. And I think when you're a young person, especially in a country like Japan, I think here too, there's a lot of pressure to follow a traditional path to something. And then to have, you know, an example of like these guys, and there's many other, you know, examples, of course, who have followed that voice. I don't know if that thought came up while they were meditating. We could say it did for purposes of this talk, but, you know, at some point they had this thought, right? And instead of just ignoring it, you know, they kind of followed that thread. And it's so inspiring for the college students. And when I was, you know, with one of the founders for a couple of weeks, just traveling around and visiting different sites and projects, I was amazed at the kind of passion and energy that he had. But it was a great reminder for me. It's like when we're fully engaged in something that we believe in, that... you know, that not only that we think is the right thing to do, but that we're passionate about, that we're enjoying, it creates its own energy, right? And one of the, I'll just say a little bit more because I just love this organization so much, a foundation. One of the things they do is they have something called the Children's Medical Fund or the Burma Children's Medical Fund. And what it does is it brings children who, you know, so the medical system in Burma has pretty much collapsed, you know, especially with the war that's going on now. But it was never great, never that developed. And Thailand is, you know, pretty much a first world healthcare system. And so what this program does is it brings out children who are sick, but they have this very, they only deal with three conditions, which are kind of congenital conditions that the children are born with. And they bring them out of Burma and into Thailand and arrange for them to get this life-saving surgery. And then, and the recovery takes months. So they support them in a kind of safe house in Chiang Mai, and they recover. And then eventually they can go back to their country. And it's like, you know, how amazing is this? And, but the way it's thought through and it's vetted. So it's not just taking anyone who's sick. It's like they know that these conditions can be basically cured with the surgery and have relationships with the surgeons and the hospitals in Thailand. And I said, well, how do you even like, you know, Thailand, if you've been to Thailand, especially in this area of Thailand by the border with Burma, there's a lot of military, a lot of checkpoints. It's not like you can kind of just, you know, it's not like the EU kind of big zone and you can kind of just go anywhere. I say, how do you get these children who have no papers and no documents and are not in the country legally from the border all the way to Chiang Mai or Bangkok where they can have the surgery? And they say, oh, we have, they know us, the military this organization creates this kind of document and volunteers kind of drive them through, and it's like a 4-hour drive and about, you know, 3 or 4 different checkpoints, and they just kind of wave them through and they see, oh, it's through, you know, Child's Dream, and they're doing this medical thing. So it takes so many different supporters and people and the goodwill of people. And, so one of the places we visited was this safe house where the children go before surgery and after surgery. And, you know, and the woman who runs it is a nurse and has been doing it for 25 years. And I think that... for me, it was a wonderful reminder that our practice is, you know, maybe to have a full practice, a complete practice, a balanced practice. It's not just about what's happening on the cushion. It's not just about what's happening in our own internal experience. That's beautiful and important. But then it's like, how do we express what we see, what we feel? You know, how do we let ourselves follow that thread of inspiration? And it will look different for each of us. One of the things that these nonprofit founders talk about with our college students is this concept of ikigai. If anyone's heard of that? This Japanese word, which, you know, I think in the traditional sense, ikigai has this meaning of your purpose, your deep purpose in life. And so to find your ikigai is a beautiful thing. But then the way they talk about ikigai is they kind of show this Venn diagram, and it's like the overlap of, I like this soundtrack. It's the overlap of what do I love doing? Okay. What am I good at? what does the world need? And then in this model of it is, what will I get paid for? How can I support myself in a way? So it's like, and it's a great model, and it's a great, you know, it's, and so the overlap of those three or four things, that, you know, they talk about as ikigai, and the students really like that. But I think in order to know what our purpose is, in order to find our ikigai, we need these moments of stopping and being still and listening to ourselves in a deep way. And so even though there can be a temptation maybe to use meditation as a sort of, you know, strategy to kind of create a mind state or an experience or something, that's okay. But when that doesn't work, you know, if you can get calm, if you can get peaceful, great, go for it. But if, like, you know, if your mind is anything like my mind, it doesn't really listen to me that much, then I would say this is when our real practice begins. And then it's like letting go of that habit to control and to fix and to open up to what's here and what's being offered, and to find the Dharma in that, to find the beauty in that, to find the goodness, and follow that thread. You know, it might even be like, oh, I should call so-and-so, or oh, I should answer that email, or I should, you know, honor that voice. You know, from these two guys, these two Swiss guys who had this idea, now it's this great, I think they might have 80 people working for them, and this amazing organization that's doing so much good in this part of the world that really needs it. And, but again, it's going to look different for everybody. And so what are your gifts? What do you have to offer the world that not only what you're good at, but what you enjoy? Because it turns out when we enjoy something, we're more likely to do it. And we're going to do it more. And then the more we do it, the better we're going to be at it. And so I feel like this practice is a portal into this deeper understanding of ourselves, deeper meeting of ourselves. And this is a great thing for us, and it can be a great thing for the world. I think maybe I'll stop here and see if anyone has a comment or question. What do you make of all this? Have you heard of this? There's a term called AI slop. You know, so much of the content that's like online or whatever is all like AI generated now. And I was thinking that we have, you know, come back to our human slop. Is it's not really slop, actually. Anyway.
Thank you. Thank you for your lecture, actually, that helped me because I struggle with the monkey mind. I've heard in other practices this idea of gently bringing the mind back. But you talked about acceptance even before that. And I'm not sure what to do because I bring it back for a few seconds and then off it goes again. So I like the idea of acceptance. It seems to make sense from a Buddhist perspective, but how should we practice? I guess is the basic question.
Yeah, thank you. It's a great question. And someone once said, Suzuki Roshi, who was a Zen teacher, Japanese Zen teacher, said something like, if it's not paradoxical, it's not true. So, yes. It's like, you know, yes, we're coming back to this moment. And we have, there are some wonderful supports in meditation for that. So one is just the awareness of the body, right? Sensations of the body are happening in the moment. And so that's why posture is often emphasized, because to maintain an upright posture, we have to have some degree of awareness or presence, or we're just kind of, you know. And so, or something like the sensations of breathing, you know, another kind of body sensation, opening to sounds in the room. So these are kind of touchstones in the present moment. But what I would say is that, and so maybe in a way, that the kind of the sort of skill of meditation or the craft of meditation is like, you know, it's a little bit like learning to drive or something, or ride a bike. It's like, you know, should I steer or should I, these days we don't have to shift so much, but it's like, should I steer or should I deal with the pedals or should I, well, yes, you've got to do it all basically, right? And we learn, or we're riding a bike. There's a certain kind of muscle memory. You know, at first it's like we're really wobbly, and it's like, okay, I just have to pedal and get some momentum. But then it's like, oh, kind of have to steer and have to. Then at a certain point, it's like, okay, my body knows how to do this. And so I kind of think about it like that. But as we're kind of starting off, I think that to cultivate that fundamental attitude of acceptance is the most important thing. Because it's like, when we're trying to do something, we're a little bit in conflict with ourselves. I want to be here. I want to be present. But my mind is thinking about yesterday or tomorrow or whatever. So it creates this division. And in meditation, the point is to have this kind of wholeness, this unity. And so this fundamental disposition of acceptance, it's sort of like lets our agendas, even our good agendas, like I want to be present, I want to be here, it lets all of that kind of quiet down a little bit. And then it turns out, when things are quiet, we're here. Where else could we be, right? You know, so it's not like the present moment is something we need to work really hard to generate or fabricate or figure out. It's like, it's all there is. When we stop fighting with ourselves, that's all there is. And so that's kind of how I see it. And the other thing I just wanted to share, this image of, like, I don't know if anyone grew up in New York City, maybe there's other places where you turn on the tap and the water, it's good water, but it's really cloudy. Anyone remember that? You know, and like, right, you know, and it's kind of almost like white. And you think, well, how can I get this water to be clear? You know, any amount of technique or stirring it or doing some different thing with it is not going to help. The only thing that works is to just leave it alone, right? We accept it, let it be still. And once it's still, all of that settles. And then it's clear. It's perfectly clear. So I think of a little bit like that. And then, yeah, let, you know, being with the body is great, being with the breath is great. To have some intention of that is very helpful.
This idea of meditating on something, is that a real thing or is that just a colloquialism?
Meditating
on something.
On like the breath?
People say they're going to meditate on something. Is that a thing?
Well, it depends what you mean by that. I mean, traditionally people will say meditate on the breath, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you might say like look at a candle flame. Or something. So you can meditate on anything. All it means is you're choosing, you have this intention of what you're aware of. So, and kind of what I'm saying is that's good, but despite, whatever our intention is, we're going to have lots of other things that happen. And it's not a mistake that those other things that's valuable too, maybe even more valuable than the candle flame or the breath or something, right? It's easy to, in a way, especially if you've gotten enamored with meditation, is to use meditation as a way of avoiding. Oh, I don't want to feel that feeling. I don't want to think about that. And if you've been good at meditating on the breath, you can just block things out. Right, that might be good. That might be useful at certain times, but basically, we want to be open and let things in. I think, and have the ability to meditate on, be aware of whatever shows up, not just this one narrow thing.
Thanks.
Hey, Max. I guess, when you're talking about the ikigai, I see some students in college and stuff, they kind of focus more on like the second and the fourth one. Mostly on the fourth one, it's like, what can I make money at? And then also like, what am I good at? But I think I'm just interested to see, how would you talk to, these young people that are trying to pick majors and stuff like that? And it's like, well, maybe you want to also consider what you enjoy doing and also what will help people. Just be interested to see what you would say to kind of help them balance those four things out a little more.
Yeah, no, thank you. It's a great question. And I think it's natural. It makes sense to, for someone who's young, who's at the start of their career, their professional life, to be thinking about how can I support myself? And so I think that's a good thing. But let's say if that were the only thing that's in the picture, I think maybe it leaves out a lot. And it's on this assumption that once I make this amount of money I want to make, then I'll be happy. And so just that encouragement to bring in what do I enjoy? What do I love doing? And the thing about what we enjoy and what we're good at, it's a little bit, for me, it's a little fuzzy because often it's, we enjoy what we're good at. Not always. It's teasing those apart is a little tricky. And, some people have said that the advice, like follow your passion is the worst advice, worst career advice or something. So, I'm never going to play in the NBA. I'm never going to be an opera singer. I'm never going to, I can listen. I love opera. Listen to it or something. But It's not like, so a little bit of reality. But then it's like, I think it's like finding ways in. It might be meditation. It might be something else. It might be like the summer program that we do. It's like the Japanese students have a roommate who's from Myanmar, who's from Burma. So totally different, both Asian countries, but like very different circumstances. And they learn so much in this relationship and connection. And yes, the Japanese students learn about Southeast Asia, but maybe even more crucially, they learn about themselves, you know. And so to have experiences of getting out, I mean, I think it's good for all of us to get out of our comfort zone, to travel, to meet different kinds of people, to do things like this. And so we're starting to little by little see more of ourselves. And then the picture kind of starts coming into focus. And the other thing that I say to the students is, probably what you do over your long life is going to change. You know, I started out doing humanities in college, and then I was in the tech world, and then, you know, doing Buddhism and meditation, and now psychotherapy, and, you know, and so, not to feel like you're going to be locked into one thing forever. But it's a great question. And maybe I'll just use this to give a little plug for my Sunday night group here, which is meeting tonight, which is for people in their 20s and 30s. And often this kind of thing is very alive, these kind of questions. So anyway, that's... Thank you. Okay. Okay, thank you very much. Take care.